Welcome to the Dialogue Studio. This podcast series is hosted by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. In it, we explore the transformational practice of dialogue and why it is important, especially in this current moment. I'm your host, Lillian Koizumi. In these episodes, you will hear from individuals from all walks of life sharing what dialogue means to them and how they are practicing it in their daily lives. We will also introduce our founder Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue and the various approaches and strategies we practice here at the center. For Ikeda, the more severe the challenges we face, the more crucial it is that we persist in dialogue, because dialogue has the power to break down the walls of mistrust, hatred, and division in the hearts of people everywhere. We hope you will join us in this endeavor to transform our world one dialogue at a time. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Dialogue Studio today. Happy April. I hope you've been doing well. I imagine that you are all navigating different challenges and conversations, especially with everything that's going on in the world today. We've been quite busy here at the center as well with our various programming and also being in dialogue with different folks about the challenges of this current moment. It seems that more than ever, genuine dialogue is needed, yet it also seems like the most difficult time to engage with others. Earlier this year, in January, we held an interfaith exchange here at the center with students from Soka University of America and scholars of different faith traditions. We were so inspired by the peace-building potential of interfaith dialogue that we witnessed in that space, so I wanted to bring some of those conversations to our podcast studio. Today, we are joined by Drs. Josh Snyder and Stephanie Edwards. Dr. Snyder is Associate Professor of the Practice in Theological Ethics at Boston College, and he participated in our January dialogue. He is also the Director of the Faith, Peace, and Justice Minor. Dr. Snyder earned his PhD in Theological Ethics from Boston College, and his research focuses on transitional justice and Catholic peacebuilding with an emphasis on the Guatemalan Catholic Church and human rights. It was during his time as a PhD student at Boston College when he met Dr. Edwards, and they've been friends ever since. Dr. Edwards is the executive director of the Boston Theological Interreligious Consortium. After undergraduate studies at Santa Clara University, Dr. Edwards spent a formative year as a Jesuit volunteer in post-Katrina New Orleans. She holds a PhD in theological ethics from Boston College, where her interdisciplinary research focused on the ties between Christian theology and trauma. Her research can be found in the Journal of the Society of Christian Ethics and Political Theology and her first book, Enfleshed Counter-Memory, A Christian Social Ethic of Trauma. During our dialogue, I asked them about their work around spirituality and interfaith dialogue, their personal journeys that led to where they are today, the importance of interfaith dialogue in this current climate, and the role of religion in bringing people together and restoring our humanity. I truly learned so much from our conversation, and I really hope that you will leave with many takeaways as well. Josh and Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us in the Dialogue Studio today. I'm really looking forward to our dialogue. We've had wonderful conversations with you two individually, and it's very exciting to bring the two of you together. So I wanted to just start our episode today, you know, considering everything that's going on in our world. I wanted to invite you to just maybe share how you're feeling in this moment, what's been really on your mind lately. Maybe we could start with that.
Sure. Well, Josh and I both work in higher education, and even if this isn't what he was thinking about, I think it's probably both important to us that our students, some of whom happen to not be from the United States, mm-hmm. are under visceral and seemingly constant threat from this administration, and that Boston has been named explicitly by the Department of Homeland Security and ICE. That students, especially from other countries, no longer have the freedom of speech, mm-hmm. and that those visas for which they worked long and hard to earn to come here to study, those are merit-based reasons for being here, seemingly do not matter, even retroactively, even for, especially up top of mind for me, is Rumeysa Ozturk and her writing as an op-ed in the Tufts student paper was enough to get her grabbed from the streets of Somerville. And I was in tears most of the latter end of last week, because it's hard not to just have a visceral emotional response to fear, which is the point, to just a depth of despair for my students. I've been notified of two. I work for a consortium, and so I've been notified of two other graduate students who have been detained that are students here within the consortium that employs me, and for no reason other than they are either in the midst of an asylum application or they happened to be suspected of having an opinion that is not shared by someone in power. And that's just terrifying, because as you are doing right now on this podcast and with the whole Ikeda Center, it's about constructive dialogue across difference. How can we come together and understand each other better, even if we do not agree? And to watch this happen is the first time in my life and in the country I was born into that I fear for my students and for all of us, quite frankly, because it does feel like a test to see how far that they can go to restrict this, the type of work you all are trying to do. And I know Josh and I are trying to do. So that's heavy on me today.
Well, thank you so much for having us here this morning. It's truly a pleasure to be here with both of you. And I really think this is a great question, because there are so many different challenges and opportunities in terms of working for peace and justice in the world that we are in today. And for me, it was kind of hard thinking about this question to kind of pinpoint it to one specific issue. But rather, there was a collection of issues that really came to my mind. And at the heart of all of them was the failure to recognize fundamental human dignity. So I think for me, like, that was really clear and apparent, that the issues that are plaguing us as a society, whether it's locally, nationally, or globally, are really rooted in this fundamental lack of concern with our fellow human beings having an inherent value and worth. And, you know, to kind of illustrate that a little bit, similar to what Stephanie was saying, right at the top was migration and mass deportation in the United States. The detaining of lawful students who are in the U.S. on visas for differences of political opinion. At Boston College, I teach in the Pulse program, which has our students engaged in year-long service opportunities. So many of our students are engaging in direct service in East Boston, in Chelsea, and many of them are in after-school programs. And the children that they're working with are fearful that their parents are going to be deported. So really, that's, you know, right at the heart of the issues. Other things that are really plaguing on my mind are, you know, thinking about what we've done to federal employees. So far, over 40,000 have been fired or let go. Approximately 30% of them are veterans. So individuals who have, you know, really committed themselves to the country. And, you know, these are career federal workers, not individuals that are, you know, the rhetoric of the time, there to get pensions, but rather career workers that are really committed to promoting the common good through civil service. And unfortunately, you know, if we look at the numbers DOGE is presenting, that's going to be about 170,000 when it's all said and done. The other big issues, dismantling of USAID, particularly thinking about what happened in Myanmar over the weekend. It's great that, you know, the administration is pledging support, but we've just gutted an agency that was really directed towards that. And again, Stephanie and I work in higher education, so what's going on with the Department of Ed? I think these are all, like, you know, just illustrations both locally, regionally, and globally that illustrate this fundamental lack of concern with human dignity and how the implications of real-life decisions impact individuals.
Yeah, tonight our good friend, who is now formerly of USAID, we'll be crashing on our couch because unceremoniously they have been ejected from their position abroad, not by any failing on their part. They are a career civil servant with expertise in the area in which they worked. And now they're being thrown back into a situation where they're happy to find work. They are competent and amazing individuals, both he and his spouse. But it's visceral because they've worked their entire lives at the service of our capacity as a country to have good global relations. Mm-hmm. Who needs democracy in the places my friends work? I will not name them because there's still ongoing questions as to their status, but it is real that they are getting their, not just their personal careers taken, but the decades of work on the ground with locals to build the things that we say we're about, which is doing good for those who are in need. And it's devastating to them to leave those posts, not just personally, but for the good of humanity, like you were saying, Josh, for this complete lack of human dignity and the willingness to engage with people we, quote unquote, don't understand, right? Just because someone wants to save a dollar.
Right. Wow. Thank you both so much for sharing so honestly. And I think, you know, Josh, we've talked a little bit about this. I know many people who work for the U.S. government, and I think there's just this wide scale level of dehumanization. And yeah, there's so many people, whether they're on the left or the right, like their fundamental identity as a human being is being challenged. And I think there's the physical exhaustion of all of it, but there's the mental exhaustion too, right? And so, yeah, we've been talking a lot about this, like, what does dialogue mean in this moment more than ever? And what is the solution? You know, and I think this idea of human dignity that you talked about, Josh, I was just reading this lecture or address that Mr. Ikeda gave in a teacher's college in 1996. And he talked about global citizenship and what does it mean to be a citizen of the world? And in it, something you said reminded me of a part of this lecture. And he says, in my opinion, the root of all of the problems that we face is our collective failure to make the human being, human happiness, the consistent focus and goal in all fields of endeavor. The human being is the point to which we must return and from which we must depart anew. What is required is a human transformation, a human revolution. So he talks about the importance of sort of this revolution of each person and what that looks like. And so, yeah, I'd love to maybe explore that a little bit more throughout the episode today. But both of you touched a little bit upon the work that you're doing now. And for our audiences, if you could share about the important work that you're doing, whether it's around spirituality or interfaith dialogue, and maybe in addition to that, like, how are you feeling about your work now more than ever? And I was wondering also if you could share a little bit about how the two of you know each other.
Sure can. Want me to get started on
this
one? Excellent, excellent. So as you may know from the introduction, professor of the practice at Boston College, working in the area of theological ethics. I also direct the Faith, Peace, and Justice program there. And one of the things I think is really important about that program, the Faith, Peace, and Justice program, is it allows our students to explore in a very structured way an interdisciplinary as well as interreligious approach to thinking very deeply about questions of peace, justice, and what faith offers, right? So how can, you know, people of goodwill, people of various faith traditions, bring their insights to play on building a more just and vibrant society. So, you know, that's kind of one of the key things in my work, you know, particularly working with students. I'll talk a little bit more about my academic interest in a minute, but that also ties to how Steph and I know each other. We go way back. Originally, we overlapped in our time together at Boston College working on our PhDs in theological ethics.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah. We won't put years out there.
No. Just, you know, a couple years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. We're just freshly minted PhDs.
Right.
Exactly. So we had met there and, you know, got to work together. One of the really cool things about, I'd say, Boston College's theological ethics program is we have this colloquium where we share the work we're working on, and we get to hear from one another and really constructively engage the work. So, you know, throughout our time together, I got to learn more about Stephanie's work there. And then in my position as director of the Faith, Peace, and Justice program, I actually get to work with Stephanie. She directs one of our senior seminars where the students put together their signature work in terms of faith, peace, and justice. I'll let her talk a little more about that. But, you know, it's just wonderful to have her guiding our students as they're kind of reaching that, like, you know, sending off commissioning point. Mm-hmm. They've really studied these issues. And now it's like, how do you take them out into the world and become agents of social change? And, you know, very happy to have Stephanie at the helm, leading them out into the world, bringing those works together. Mm. So in terms of my work, my primary academic interests really look at the role of religious communities and religious institutions as positive agents of social change within civil society and their role for overcoming injustice. Specifically, I look at the role of institutions in peace building and looking at how religious communities can be agents of social change in terms of transitioning from either post-conflict situations or authoritarian regimes to becoming peaceful, pluralistic democracies. Mm. So that's, you know, something that I've really been focused on. And you know, if you want to get really granular about it, I look at like sort of the role of the Catholic Church and its institutions in bringing about peace in Central America, particularly in the Guatemalan Catholic Church, bringing their 36-year civil war to an end. And I think, you know, sort of the benefit of this religiously inspired approach to peace building is that it brings together some rather high moral ideals, things like love, justice, forgiveness, and reconciliation that we see in many religious traditions, right? It's not, I don't think any religion has a unique monopoly on those traditions.
Right.
But bringing those together to acknowledge, you know, in the presence of sinful structures and human weakness, how can these faith traditions help to overcome divides, right? And the importance of promoting peace in a way that is participatory and, you know, embracing of the dignity of all human beings. And I think that's kind of a unique contribution that religions offer. You know, governments can inculcate systems of rights, contracts, sort of these are the bare bones of what it means to be a democratic citizen. But if we think about values and virtues, that's the domain of religious institutions. And in civil society, they can kind of help promote this in a way that builds up the common good by, you know, working towards shared values.
You know, as a staff of the center, we loved learning from you, Josh, and about your work, because I think a lot of the narratives right now around religion is that in the history of religion, right, it's always been a point of conflict or tension, but that, you know, learning about your work is helping us really think about how does religion really bring us together and how do the values of different religious traditions bring us together. And that's something I, you know, want to talk with the both of you about a little bit later. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, well, that's actually a great setup for my work. Along with working with Josh and the Faith, Peace, and Justice program at Boston College, my full-time gig is actually the executive director of the Boston Theological Interreligious Consortium, better known as the BTI. The BTI is an almost 60-year-old, first ecumenical Christian and now explicitly interreligious consortium of all the schools in the greater Boston area that offer graduate programs in religious studies, theology, and broadly what we call divinity, which are students who are seeking a master's or a PhD or a doctorate in order to serve at the practical level, to be clergy, to be lay leaders, chaplains, all of those related professions. And the BTI's mission is to facilitate interreligious community, not just through professional development or cross-registration for classes, which is, of course, part of our purview, but really it's to bring students together under what we draw from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks's concept, the dignity of difference, that there's absolutely no just reason that we should collapse our uniqueness in order to find common ground, but rather that our uniqueness, when brought fully to the fore, usually in quite a vulnerable offering, is the foundation for real pluralism, is the foundation for real peacemaking. And because we have students that represent truly every political stance, every religious iteration you can dream of. I mean, it's Boston. So think of the student who comes here from Nepal to become a Buddhist chaplain at Harvard and the parish priest in development at St. John's Roman Catholic Seminary, right? Those are often diametrically opposed young people. but the BTI's aim is to bring them into fruitful conversation, to have students enter each other's spaces authentically and say, I'm here to listen and learn from you. I would like to learn the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, at Hebrew College Rabbinical School. I would like to sit with a scholar of Talmud and understand how it's taught, not just to my ears as a Christian, but through the mouths and beliefs of Jewish people. And of course, vice versa, right? And across any and all differences you can dream up. And it's a real gift to be in this position. I've been here since March 2020. It's been quite a ride. An auspicious start date. It doesn't seem to be getting smoother. However, being with students throughout first the pandemic and then the uprisings of summer 2020 and now through this current upheaval, it's heartening to see them dig deep into their commitment to interreligious education, to really saying, I know that we can be different because I want to be different. And so how can I pursue opportunities that open myself up to learning? There's a great saying from John Sobrino, who is a Salvadoran priest that both I know Josh and I draw a lot of strength from. And he used to say it a lot to students, that it matters who you put yourself in the way of. And that is a choice you can make. It doesn't mean that the outcome is guaranteed. It doesn't mean that there's some sort of epiphany that's bound to happen. But it does mean that it matters that you took the chance to put yourself in the way of someone. And he meant that in a positive way, not as a blockade. I'm sure it sounds better in the original Spanish. But alongside this beautiful work with the BTI, I do get to teach students. And teaching is how I identify myself. I come from a lineage of teachers, my mother included, a 20-year veteran of elementary education, which I am not called to. but I found myself really coming into a realization about how I wanted to make change in the world and how I wanted to be a positive agent when I started teaching. And being a professor within the Faith, Peace, and Justice program is an incredibly meaningful task that I take up joyfully every year, because it, as Josh mentioned, it really is this pivotal point in students' lives when they're taking their first job offers, when they're deciding whether or not to do a year of service, to take a gap year, to give themselves some grace, which the higher achieving students of Boston College are not apt to do. And I get to sit with them in that discernment process. And as we learn about their passion for whatever specific justice topic they've decided to write about or to engage, we also get to engage what they're going to do about it, not just within their scholarship, but within their life. And that's a really powerful part of what I do. That comes from the fact that not only do I have two jobs currently, but I also have two professions. Before I did all of this work, as Josh mentioned, we are both theological ethicists, both came through the same PhD program. I was a social worker, and I worked with mostly adult victims of crime and refugees who were resettling in the greater Boston area. And prior to that, I lived in post-Katrina New Orleans, working with mostly unhoused persons and helping the Jesuit province in that area try to help rebuild the city after the storm. And all of that social work education, social work practice is deeply embedded in who I am. I don't see teaching, I don't see higher education, I don't see the work of the BTI as anything but helping people flourish. And if I can use the skills that I have from quote unquote the real world to engage students in the pursuit of what they are passionate about, then it's a win for me. And so my research comes out of that dual professionalism. So my niche, as we all do in the academic world, when we dig down to the granular, is trauma and Christian theology, and specifically how attitudes and beliefs about mental health and mental health treatment are informed by and can then also inform our theological work and our belief systems. And for me, like I said, as a social worker, but also as a teacher, The ways in which our brains and bodies experience the world and experience suffering are intimately tied with what we think about and how we hope and how we construct social justice and how we think about what we can and cannot do. So when I'm researching, I'm thinking deeply about how we experience pain, but also even more so how we can how we enact resilience. That's often a buzzword that's thrown around, but it's real. Humans are incredibly resilient. Our brains, bodies, and hearts are really capacious and really beautiful. And so trying to draw out how all those things fit together within the umbrella of Christian theological ethics is where I do my writing.
Wow. I just want to re-emphasize how honored I am to have both of you in this space right now. And I think at the center, we love scholar practitioners. And I feel like both of you really embody your scholarly work, but you really are engaging with the work personally. And Steph, when I first learned that you're a social worker, I was like, this makes so much sense. Because all the social workers that I know in my life are the most capable people who do everything all at once. And still hold space for other people. And that's the vibe I got from you when I met you. So I was like,
also,
oh, it makes sense she has a social worker.
What my therapist tells me to do is chill out.
None of the social workers I know are chill, but they're wonderful.
She's like, you could do not one of those things. And I'm like, I don't think so.
But I love what you said about the dignity of difference.
Yeah.
And I think, I feel like we've talked about this with both of you, but we've been having so many conversations these days about just the inability for people to sit with difference these days. And we met recently, Steph, Jimmy McCarty, through your introduction. And we were talking about conflict transformation with him. And I love this idea of how we can actually use conflict as an opportunity for transformation, right? Mm-hmm. To see conflict as, to not be afraid of conflict, but to see it as sort of an opportunity to engage in some kind of transformation together. And I think that's something that a lot of our youth, at least, are really grappling with. Like when we did the interfaith exchange earlier in the year with Josh, and then Mosaic, who, again, Steph, you introduced us to, a lot of the young people who came to have this interfaith exchange, they expressed to us how they want to engage in dialogue across difference, how they want to be able to bring their full self into a room, whether it's their religious traditions, their personal, you know, experiences, but they're afraid to sit in a room together. And I feel like listening to the both of you, I think that that's something that so many people are seeking these days, but they don't know how to start that process. And I think even when I was witnessing the interfaith panel, Josh, with you and the other scholars, it really, you know, I'm a Buddhist, and I didn't think that I would have this experience, you know, witnessing this interfaith dialogue, this panel, but it gave me hope, and it actually reinforced my own commitment as a Buddhist, but it deepened my appreciation for the purpose of religion and how religion was created so that people could live better lives. But over time, it gets lost. And then we end up with, you know, these points of conflict as a result of our religious differences. But actually, genuine interfaith exchange really, like, brings out of our lives this like deep sense of appreciation for the interconnectedness of all life. So thank you both for what you shared. And there's so much about your work that I'd love to unpack further. But before we do that, you know, just going back to a couple years ago when you entered your PhD programs, you know, just a couple years back, I was just very curious if you could share your personal journeys leading up to that point. Like, what inspired you to pursue the PhD work you do? As you both know, all the PhD students we talk to, some of them, you know, halfway through, they don't want to be academics anymore. There's a shared experience of being a doctoral student, for sure. So I just was wondering if you could share a little bit about, yeah, your personal journeys.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I have a winding path, as was probably indicated by my many hats. But I will say that the focus on justice work and peace building has been a consistent through line, right? Everything's clear in hindsight. But as a kid, I grew up fully secular. I grew up unchurched, and I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which at that time in the 90s was at the height of the WTO riots, was at the height of anti-war at the end of my high school career, right? We were entering Iraq, and large-scale resistance against the conservative government of the time. And so as a little whippersnapper, I took to these ideas around justice and around equity really early. Mm. There's probably something in there because I'm an eldest daughter. I don't know. Mm. But
I relate.
But there is something true to me that drew me towards this early protest work. I also loved punk rock, still do. But like, you know, I had this in me that was like, there's something about being with other people in order to demand what you know is right that is a compulsive mover in who I am. And when I showed up to undergraduate, I went to Santa Clara University in Northern California. I did not know what a Jesuit was. Mm-hmm. A Jesuit, by the way, is a certain denomination of Catholic priest that their charism, as we call in Catholicism, which means the thing that you choose to emphasize within your group. What is your shtick? Mm. What's your thing? So all these little pieces, right? I was a non-Catholic entering this space. I was like, it's different than just the guy back in my hometown with the collar. They're different. Why do they wear a different? Why do they have a dress and they have pants? Like, I truly was swimming in deep water. But I came to learn that this particular part of the Catholic Church was really dedicated to faith through understanding. So that's St. Anselm. You know, I can't take credit. But it was really this group founded on the idea that through deep reflection, through what St. Ignatius called the examine, and through engagement with scholarship, that there was something to be gained in your journey to God. So it was not just this is a good thing to do materially, but it's a great thing to do for your soul. Now, I don't want to shy away from the fact that the Jesuits have a pretty shoddy history, as you've mentioned about all religions, and especially that the Catholic Church has a pretty rough road to hoe, as they say, out in this world history and current history that we share. However, when I got to Santa Clara, I was taken in by these deeply intellectual people who identified with this tradition and were putting this activism that I'd been so drawn to in my youth together with a religious worldview. And that rocked me. I had no idea that Christians could be anything but hypocrites. I had no idea that the Catholic Church could do anything but abuse children. I had no entree into this really progressive, really socially justice-minded part of a faith tradition I'd fully written off. And not for unjust reasons. And through my college career, I ended up studying in El Salvador. And I think at that moment, again, hindsight, I can pin the beginning of my conversion. I was living and working with people that had so deeply, literally fought for their lives and their ability to continue having their family be free. And through that experience, I started observing the Mass with these communities because it's such a culturally salient part of their daily lives. That through my work, I started going to church. And then little by little, when I got back, I was like, oh, I actually want to go back. Weird. never thought that would be a part of my journey. And I followed it through. And it really was a life-changing event. I, like I mentioned, ended up committing to the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, which was the group I served with in New Orleans, and then did what's called the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults here in Boston, and became Catholic in 2010. And this is all before I decided to become a theologian. At the time, I thought, oh, I found this bucket of transcendence. I've always been drawn to the fact that there's something beyond what we can see, touch, and feel. And Catholicism and a faith in Jesus really brought that out in me. It clearly became my truth. Otherwise, good Lord, why would you become Catholic? But I really became convinced of this as my personal faith and my personal journey, thinking it would be divorced from what I did for work, thinking that my social work would be my life. And when that ended up not being the case, when I couldn't physically or mentally do that type of work anymore, I sat back in discernment. I did the examine intentionally that St. Ignatius created. I did it independently for a year, and I discerned my way into a PhD. Who knew? And it really became this beautiful bucket for how I can fit all the bits of my life into one story. And I mean, you shouldn't do anything just because it has organizational power. But again, for my type A eldest daughter shtick, it really works for me. No, but also theological ethics is a gorgeous field of study for me because it makes a truth claim about the world. Mm. It says we are here to do justice, to walk humbly with our God, Micah 6:8. We are here to do these things, not just because they are good in and of themselves, that is beautiful, but we are called to do so because they have a transcendent meaning for why we are here and what this is all about ultimately. And so I feel really lucky that I not only have my personal journey, but also my professional journey together every day, that I can wake up and feel that there's consonance between those two things, because that's a rare gift. And I know that it should not be one that we take for granted.
Well, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to follow that up. I feel that there's a lot of points of continuity between Stephanie and my story, which you'll hear pretty soon in terms of our experiences with regard to peace and justice and the transformative effect of religion in our lives. But unlike Steph, I grew up as a cradle Catholic, right? So I was born into my particular religious tradition. Lillian, as I shared with you previously, my mother was Catholic, but my father was sort of a seeker within Christianity. Mm. So he would go to different Christian communities to try to feel where he felt the most authentically himself and at home. So even though I had no idea what ecumenical dialogue was as a little kid, I was engaged in it, right? Mm-hmm. I would go to Mass with my mother. I would go to other religious services with my father. Wow. And it really had a profound influence on me. So I grew up in a house where faith was of utmost importance, but it wasn't faith as sort of middle class habit. It was faith that actually meant something, right? Yeah. It was a faith, I love, Stephanie, your point about transcendence, right? It was a faith that provided an opportunity to encounter the divine in a very real and profound way. And that was a beautiful opportunity to grow up in that environment. But it really wasn't until college, and I love to give a shout out to my undergrad institution, St. Peter's University in Jersey City. Go yes. Peacocks, right? right? Peacocks, strut
They're
up.
Beautiful.
Strut up. And it was at St. Peter's that my faith really found its mature form, right? It was great to be surrounded by other young adults who are your age, who are also committed to your faith. And also being in Jersey City in the late 1990s was a wonderful opportunity, right? It was a diverse community. St. Peter's College, at the time it was college, now it's university, was known as a first-generation college. So there were a lot of individuals coming from diverse backgrounds and coming together. And to me, that was wonderful. And it was here that my faith became one that really was engaged in justice through involvement with things like campus ministry. Jersey City was right across from Manhattan in New York City. So to be there in the mid to late 90s was transformative. And that's where I would say my faith took the character of discipleship, that faith needs to lead to action, a fancy word, praxis, right? Us ethicists, we have to throw out praxis every now and again, right? So that our faith would result in this intentional activity that was engaged in hopefully bettering the lives of other people. So after my undergrad, I had the opportunity to work on a master's at Villanova University, and this also provided another transformative opportunity. It was here that I first learned about Guatemala and the fact that they had just completed a 36-year civil war. So in 2001, while working on my master's degree, I was finding out about this profound experience that had occurred in the country. As Stephanie mentioned, at a Jesuit institution, I learned a lot about El Salvador, the Jesuit martyrs, the Marinol sisters, faith and justice. I had no idea about Guatemala. And it was through an encounter while I was in Villanova working on my master's that I began to learn about the Guatemalan Civil War. It was a lecture, and a family that had actually fled from the Department of Petén in Guatemala was here to talk about how they experienced persecution due to their religious faith, being Maya indigenous people, and how they had to flee from the an authoritarian government. So again, it was like encounter, right? Yeah. Meeting people, and this was transforming, ooh, what I wanted to do. Mm. So their stories of religious perseverance in the face of ethnic persecution really like had a, laid an indelible mark on me. So after my master's, I was like, I need a break, right? I'm not ready. I wasn't even thinking of a PhD. Mm. And I got a job in campus ministry. So for 7 years, I was directing campus ministry at Rosemont College. Shout out to Rosemont. And was able to work on like really developing a thriving social justice program there that was both regional as well as global in its scope. Mm. And again, you know, like having encounters was essential to the faith that was developing. Mm. So through this 7 years of working campus ministry, I also got the opportunity to teach for the first time. Mm. And this is where like sort of it clicked, right? Mm. Being in a classroom with, you know, young adults, and raising questions about the importance of faith, that was, you know, profound. And that led me on sort of the trajectory for the rest of my life. Mm. And a really cool thing. So I was relatively young at this point, teaching my first class. And I got to teach with a wonderful scholar who works in interreligious dialogue and peace building, Paul Moises. Mm. So shout out to Paul, at Rosemont College. He was a survivor of his father had passed away during World War II. He was killed by the communists. Mm. He was a survivor of what happened in the Balkans, what was later to become Yugoslavia. Mm. And he was committed to interfaith dialogue and peace building. Mm. And as a young kid, getting to team teach with a guy who had all this lived experience, it was like, wow, this is again transformative moment. And through those 7 years of working with young adults as they were pursuing their faith, getting to the opportunity to teach and getting that bug, that led me to think, I need to get a PhD. Mm-hmm. I mean, I need to have the opportunity for this to be a nice integrated life. I loved campus ministry, but I knew what my real vocation was being in the classroom with undergrads. So for me, you know, having the amazing opportunity to go to Boston College, study under some of the most incredible theological ethicists in the world, and commit to working for peace and justice and developing an ethical approach to peace building was, you know, an amazing opportunity. In terms of thinking about like sage advice for those who are thinking about a PhD, my big question would be, does the PhD resonate with your sense of authenticity? Yeah. Is this something you're getting a credential because you need a credential?
Right.
Or is this something that you need because it's who you are? And I think there's a big difference there. Yeah. Yeah. Authenticity and the ability to combine the different facets of your life together in a meaningful way so that you become a complete whole, I think, is an amazing gift. It's an amazing opportunity. Mm-hmm. Stephanie, you talked beautifully about this, right? That theological ethics for I think both Stephanie and myself provided an opportunity to combine those elements of our life in a way that, you know, you don't really have the opportunity to do in other venues. So for me, you know, the PhD was an opportunity to cultivate the virtue of authenticity, to become an integral human being, combining academic passions, faith commitments, and my concern for those who are marginalized in a way that, you know, led me to being this wonderful room with you guys right now. Yeah.
Wow. I wish I could play that, Josh, for all of the PhD students to come into the building. Amen. I'll just play it through the speakers. Yeah. You know, just very recently, we've met with two PhD students in two separate occasions who talked about sort of, you know, getting lost along the way and having to go back to their why. And I think there's a lot of, when you talked about authenticity, Josh, you know, starting their PhD work because of their passion about one thing, but then feeling sort of pulled in different directions as their PhD develops and sort of all the external pressures and sort of asking like, how did I even get here? You know, so I think that idea of authentic, to go back to that, like their sort of prime point, right? Their original point is so important.
And Josh, seeing you with your students in action, you know, we had the great fortune of attending two classes that Josh was in. And I can see this, the joy you had with your students was contagious. You know, I just remember thinking, like, I wish I had a professor like Josh when I was in college. I think I would have maybe thought about pursuing my education further. And so I felt that. We felt that when we were there. And the last thing I wanted to just respond to is this importance of encounter that you talked about. And I think it's really profound that both of you were really grappling with these, like, fundamental questions in your life, and then somehow it led you right to these paths that you're in. And I think whether you're religious or not, just listening to the two of you, I thought, wow, it's so important. I think I wish there was more opportunities for people, for young people, to learn about faith traditions. Yeah. You know, and I think because of all these misconceptions, like I was forced into a Christian school as a kid because my grandfather was Christian, and my Christian school was horrible. You know, my teachers were horrible. They threw Bibles at us. Like, you know, it was just a very horrible experience. And so I just thought, if this is what Christianity is about, then I'm never going to do it. So I went atheist and I became a Buddhist. But then coming back to this moment, and again, that interfaith exchange we had, Josh, I really felt like, wow, there's so much about different religions that I don't understand. And even just like scratching the surface of it, it made me think, like, we can solve the many problems that we face in the world if all of us come together and engage in dialogue and mutual understanding. And so, but religion is such, right, a point of tension. And so I just really appreciate the individual stories that you shared. And just, again, this reminder of the importance of religious and interfaith conversations at this time. And so I kind of want to segue now to this interfaith exchange we had, Josh, with your students that was so meaningful for our listeners, a group of students from Soka University of America, which is another university founded by our founder, Mr. Ikeda. They were part of this short research course on religion and peace building. And so they traveled here to Boston, and we had an interfaith exchange here with Josh and other scholars. And then they then went to Boston College to meet with Josh's students. And I think we've all been reflecting on sort of the importance of that encounter. And so I was just wondering if you could share a little bit, we touched upon this throughout the conversation, but just in this current climate, like, what do you think is the importance of interfaith dialogue, and what's the potential for interfaith dialogue that you'd like to see more of? And sort of adding on to this question, Steph, I think when we met with you, you know, we talked a lot about young people's, your observation of young people's relationship to religion at this time. And if religion can be such a key part of our peace building efforts, how do we engage young people at this time who maybe have lost faith in religious traditions?
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful question. In terms of interfaith dialogue, I do think it's essential for addressing social injustices and building peace. If we think about it, like, sort of at the academic level, by the 1990s, interreligious dialogue was really emerging as an effective tool to address conflict. So thinking of sort of like the wars of disintegration in the former Yugoslavia, and particularly the power of interreligious dialogue in a country like Bosnia-Herzegovina, right, where you had Catholics, Orthodox, and Muslims who were engaging in dialogue to think about creative ways to coexist. So, you know, I think since that time, it's been really important to see this as a, you know, potential tool for building up peace, you know, if we're thinking that high level. But I also think it's really essential at, like, sort of the interpersonal level. And, you know, thinking about approaches to interfaith dialogue, really there's two essential things that I think we can try to accomplish in dialogue, right? First, and I think this is really, really important, that by engaging another person of a different faith tradition, it promotes tolerance, or it could promote tolerance. Obviously, I want to talk about this in a positive perspective. But the ability for dialogue to promote tolerance and understanding between faith traditions, right? In this way, interreligious or interfaith dialogue, the goal is to find common ground and work to foster mutual respect. So I think that's a really important goal with interfaith dialogue. A second dialogue is to think about how can we talk about substantive theological issues that are going to remain different. Mm-hmm. And Stephanie talked earlier about this idea of the dignity of difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. we can't simply translate all of our religious beliefs into a common language, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be willing to embrace and respect diversity and difference. And there may not always be common ground. For example, if you're engaged in like sort of a tri-dialogue between the Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, one of the sticking points is going to be the distinctiveness of who Jesus the Christ is, mm-hmm. right? You're going to come at that with a fundamental claim from a Christian perspective that's not going to be held by your Jewish and Muslim brothers mm-hmm. and sisters. And to be okay with that, right? Yeah. I think that's a key point of interfaith dialogue, that we're not going to just reconcile all the differences of faith tradition, but to be able to respect that difference and see it as actually a gift that we can be willing to live amongst ourselves with diverse faith traditions and not try to find, okay, everything needs to be common, right? So when done properly, I think interfaith dialogue can teach us quite a few things. Mm. First and foremost, what does it mean to dialogue? So many of us, I think, are in a conversation waiting for our point to talk. Yeah. you know, like, is it my turn? Is it my turn? Whereas a genuine dialogue is about listening. Listening to your whoever you're engaging in a way that you're really eager to learn from them, right? I think that's something that interreligious dialogue can teach us. It can teach us how to show respect, tolerance, and understanding. Point of dialogue, to acknowledge difference in a way that's, you know, respectful. It can build, I think, confidence in our ability to live together. If we can sit there and be present to each other, acknowledging difference, we can be confident that, yes, these differences don't need to push us into different enclaves where we don't interact, right? But rather, there's something beautiful about coming together and talking about this from vastly different respects and perspectives. Another point would be, I think it, interreligious dialogue helps us repair individual and collective pain. I don't want to step on Stephanie's area of trauma, right? She could probably talk a lot more about this, but there are tools within different religious traditions that talk about individual and collective pain, whether it's lamentations in the Jewish tradition to give voice to like the cathartic pain we experience. And I think that's beautiful, right? To see how different religious traditions can bring that together and help us to voice in moments of grief and suffering our collective pain. Dialogue helps to correct stereotypes, right? If you don't engage the other, you're not going to know about the other. So I think that's really important, correcting stereotypes, correcting misinformation that you might have about another religious tradition. Interreligious dialogue really, I think, also helps us to foster forgiveness. And to sort of inculcate a disposition where I can be willing to forgive another person and hopefully get to a point of reconciliation. So I think those are like sort of the wonderful contributions that interfaith and interreligious dialogue can offer. Obviously, they can lead to, you know, fights and conflicts, conflict in a positive way and conflict in a negative way as well. Right. But I think there is a huge potential there for interfaith dialogue to be really productive. And a last thing I would point to, beyond just dialogue, interfaith exchanges like the one we had, right, brought students together to create a common project. They were just there to learn from each other, right? It wasn't really just the dialogue itself, but what's a common project that we could work on? And, you know, from that initial group of people meeting together, we're like, what can we do next, right? And I think that's sort of the value of interfaith exchanges. It leads us to think about, you know, how can we create a new future? How can we engage in activities that are going to be transformative?
Thank you, Josh. I love the way you talked about the different ways you talked about dialogue. And it reminded me of one of Ikeda's quotes on dialogue. And he said that dialogue is the courageous willingness to know and be known. And I love that he used the word courageous and the word willingness. You know, it's a choice we have to make and it requires courage. And I wanted to ask a quick follow-up before we turn it over to Steph. You know, we talked about this respect for difference, right? And I was wondering, Josh, if you could speak a little bit about maybe for yourself personally, like in these moments of sort of high tension, what are some ways that you've talked to your students about this? Like, how do we really put that into practice? Because I think this idea of being able to really respect to in the moment of difference, to choose respect, mm-hmm. despite maybe that difference challenging fundamentally who you are? Like, what are some ways, whether it's your faith or just your practices over the years, like, how do we really put that into practice, I guess? And do you find that to be more difficult in this current moment?
Great follow-up question. I love the practicality. Yeah. Right? Like, I think that's really important. And what I would say many faith traditions offer is this moment of interiority, to turn within.
Yeah.
And when faced with difference, one reaction could be to reject the difference, right?
Right, right.
I want to yell at you because you're different from
right.
me. Rather than let me pause, you know, take a moment. Mm. And, you know, through whatever, whether it's meditation, prayer, centering activities that your faith tradition teaches you, I think that's really valuable to be in a heated moment and to have that sense of a pause, an internal movement where let me find my place of calm, my place of peace, so that I can actually engage in this in a meaningful way. When we're tense and we're really, you know, heated about something that we're very passionate about, we can lose sight of that. So I think that's essential, right?
And
different religious traditions provide practices. This is the great thing about religion. They provide practices to help us to become mindful, to become centered, and not simply react in a visceral way when we're faced with diversity. I think that's super hard, right?
Right,
you know, this isn't easy. This takes time. And, you know, the more you practice these different skills, the better you will become. And, you know, one of the skills that I've been really impacted with is the idea of nonviolent communication. How can we respond to the other from our own place of authentic self, listen to what their needs might be, and respond in a way that is respectful of their needs and your own needs?
Yeah. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah, I love nonviolent communication, but unfortunately, not even the majority, even 51% of us practice it.
Mm-hmm.
And I include myself in the part that is often not practicing it. Something that this reflection is making me think of is how often I revisit the conversation about discomfort versus harm with my students. Because I work and have worked in mental health, because I work specifically with trauma, which is a word that gets bandied about daily, sometimes as a joke, sometimes meaning something quite real, I revisit that because when you are faced with difference, and in this I mean someone who is potentially trying to not only, like you said, counter an opinion you have, but who you are. And there is a difference between having that conversation about a difference of opinion versus attacking another for the essence of who they are,
right.
whether it be their race, their ethnicity, their sexuality, their gender, whatever it is. And when I talk to my students about how to practically go about life right now, I ask them to sit with those same gifts from their tradition, from their spirituality that Josh was talking about, and say, when I go to family dinner, when I go to the mixed friend group outing, when for some reason my poor theology student ends up in the College of the School of the Science of Management, as BC calls its business school, how do you navigate that difference?
Right.
And it is through practice. You cannot do interfaith dialogue or even cross-political dialogue without practice. And if you are not in a space where there are rules that the group has agreed to follow, that there is a assumption of goodwill in the room, then we're not actually doing the work. And what's going to happen is you're going to tip over into harm quite quickly. You may have started from, oh, this is uncomfortable, but this is my friend's new boyfriend. Oh, this is kind of weird. And but he's my uncle. and then we're not in a space that actually is meant for dialogue. We're in a space where someone is not agreeing to the same ground rules that we have in our head.
Yeah.
So I revisit that conversation a lot because it is not your responsibility to save everyone that you meet, but at the same time, it is your responsibility to present your best self within those circumstances. And oftentimes in the real world, in the day-to-day life stuff, not in the CADA Center, not in FPJ, not at the BTI, you're going to have to leave those situations. And that is courageous too, because leaving a situation that is harmful, that is out to challenge the core of who you are as a person with dignity is not a place for dialogue. It's not a place for you to stay. That being said, that's such hard discernment work because I talk with a lot of scholars of trauma, not just about the individual level, but about the collective. And I've lived and worked in Bosnia and the Balkans. And when we talk with groups of people about what it takes to be in those rooms at all, it's incredibly difficult, and even being there can feel like an instance of harm.
Right.
So my goodness, is it the depth of interior work you have to do. And it is at times quite risky to yourself because you are asking yourself to be vulnerable in front of or in the face of someone you know you disagree with or has a certain opinion or belief system about you. And there's this gorgeous essay by W.E.B. Du Bois that he wrote in 1949 when he was part of an international group that was asked to go to Warsaw. And it's a short piece. I'd recommend you read it. It's called The Negro in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he stood in the middle of Warsaw and said, oh, my God, I'm wrong. It is true that my suffering and the suffering of Black people in the U.S. is horrific, and it is true, and it must be resisted. And yet, it does not come in first place in some suffering Olympics ahead of the suffering of the Jews in Warsaw,
right?
Ahead of the suffering of someone else. And so he, from that point, consistently writes about this dual vision that you have to maintain both the particularity of yourself, but the universal nature that everyone shares in these experiences, and that we are not out to beat each other, particularly when it comes to how hard off we have it. And that we have to instead cultivate a way to see two things at the same time. I often reference this F. Scott Fitzgerald quote that the mark of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas at the same time and still continue to function. And I think he means not just function like get through the day, but create like good, creative, beautiful work in the world. And I think Du Bois agrees with that statement that it does matter how deeply we feel things and how much we've suffered. There's almost nothing more that matters. However, it matters that we can see that in the other as well. And interfaith dialogue and the interreligious practices you guys have been talking about are some of the practical ways that we try to peel back those layers so we can get to this point of view where we're not competing with each other anymore, but we are trying to sit with each other and sit in that creative tension between two ideas or two ways of being that seem to oppose each other. And I think that that honestly is my hook to my students, because even if they don't identify as spiritual or religious or don't or want actively to leave whatever faith tradition that they were raised in, they do want to be smart. they do, right? They don't go to college if you're like, well, whatever. They want to become truly, when I see them each semester as a new group, I say, my God, these young people want to be the best that they can be. They really want to be fully formed human beings. they're already there, but they're also on the journey to being who they are going to be as adults. And I think that if you're honest with them about their experience, if you do not negate or undercut any of their own suffering or any of their experiences, especially in religious education, you can find ways that they realize who they want to be and what they actually want to believe in. So it's creating spaces for creative spirituality, creating spaces for understanding that the religion you were raised in is maybe not the way you were taught that it is. When they see me and for the listener, I'm so young. No, when they,
I can confirm that.
No, but when they see me in front of the classroom and not an 80-year-old priest at a Catholic school, right? I identify as a Catholic theologian. They go, oh, what's going to happen in here? And that we are, then make an environment where they can ask these really hard questions and they can say, well, Sister Margaret Mary said, and I get to say, well, no. And also to have that be okay, that there are these questions of doubt, these things that you've been taught by your grandmother that you thought were church teachings, or that you were abused in a religious situation, and I have to reemphasize that that is not just and is not right and it is not the teaching of the religious environment that you were in. And that is where you gain trust. Mm. And that is where you start to open religion or spirituality back up to a population that often wants to just throw it away with the bathwater.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing, Steph. And everything you shared was so moving. And it really made me think about like this idea of suffering and that everybody has suffering in their life. And
well, I mean, you're a good Buddhist.
So. Yes, that's right. That's the number one thing we do as Buddhists. There's a scholar, Melissa Bradford, and she looked at Ikeda's dialogues over the years and came up with this ethos that she thought Ikeda carried as he engaged in dialogue. And one of them was this idea that because we all have suffering, we can connect with each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that... Yeah, I just, as I was listening to you, I just thought, wow, I just wish we had more and more structured spaces like these for people to enter and engage in this kind of work. But like, how do we get the people in the room, you know, is I think the work that we're all trying to do in our respective places, right? And so I just appreciate the two of you so, so much. Because we could talk for so much longer, and this has been like so just meaningful, and we are a little bit over time. So I think I'm going to wrap the last two questions together, if that's okay. I sent this to you in advance, but our founding lecture, we consider this our founding lecture, in 93, Ikeda gave a lecture at Harvard's Yenching Institute on Mahayana Buddhism and 21st century civilization. And in it, he talked about the role of religion in restoring our humanity. And so in it, he says, does religion make people stronger or does it weaken them? Does it encourage what is good or what is evil in them? Are they made better and more wise or less by religion? These, I believe, are the criteria we must keep firmly in view. And so I was just wondering if we could wrap up our conversation today, you know, just thinking about the context of this moment, what do you feel, and I know we touched upon this throughout the conversation, is the role of religion in restoring our humanity and our efforts to create peace? And sort of along with that, and again, we've talked about this a number of times throughout our dialogue, but how do we continue to see religion as a source of unity and solidarity rather than this current narrative of being a source of conflict and division?
All right, let me take a shot at this. Great question.
Light and complicated.
Yes. Easy one to finish up, right? Softball. I think religion can either disinhibit or inhibit violence, right? And it really exists on a spectrum. Our human inclination towards peace building or violence is on a spectrum, and it's impacted by myriad issues, right? Whether it be our genetics, our upbringing, our early encounters of violence, how we've experienced religion in our community, all of that's going to impact how we understand religion and whether or not that religion is going to unite us with others or lead us into sort of our own little, separatist enclave. So I think happy, healthy people who are inherently inclined towards peacemaking will focus on sacred texts and spiritual practices that are commensurate with their understanding of peace. Those who might be bitter or hurt or dealing with past wrong might be attracted to texts that seem to sanction violence. And the majority are probably somewhere in between, right? And I think that's the power of religion, trying to reach that in-between group.
Yeah.
Those who are in the middle of the spectrum and can be drawn either way. And that religions can foster dialogue and unity by offering, I think, visions of the good, albeit they're all limited, right? Each one of our religions presents us with a claim about what constitutes the good, as well as sets of practices, whether they be rituals or prayers, that help participants construct a collective identity and participate at various levels in different activities that could be directed toward the good, right? So religions can foster unity and dialogue by emphasizing moral behavior, by emphasizing things like inclusion that we've talked about earlier, respect for human dignity, that we have a moral obligation to the other, precisely as other, right? Not making them like us, but we have obligations to the other, and that it's our obligation to work towards their well-being as well. Lillian, earlier you talked about the idea of happiness, right? I love that idea, and, you know, it's sort of thinking about eudaimonia in the Greek, human flourishing, right? That the happy life is the flourishing human being.
Right.
And religions offer this vision of what this flourishing life could be. And it's one that doesn't necessarily run away from suffering. Right. It's one that acknowledges the suffering other as a legitimate claim on my own well-being.
Right.
And offers us a set of tools to try to grapple with that. So kind of to bring my thoughts sort of to a close on this, I want to highlight Pope Francis's call to like a culture of encounter. I think that's a really great way of thinking about the potential of religion to bring together unity, foster a sense of solidarity. So what does it mean to sort of create a culture of encounter? And I think it goes back to the first thing we talked about, recognizing the fundamental human dignity of every human being, right? That we all have an intrinsic value and worth that's not dependent on anything we do. It's not a capabilities argument, but simply by being, we have value and worth, right? So a culture and encounter, first and foremost, calls us to recognize that. Then encounter requires us to get proximate, right? I need to get close to those who I may not want to get close to, right? It's nice to be in a really warm room, comfortable room like we're in today with two wonderful people. But my faith tradition also calls me to go beyond that.
Right.
Comfortable space, right? That we need to shift our gaze to those who are marginalized, those who are being subjugated by the structures that society, different governments create. And by turning our gaze to the margins, we're called to meet our brothers and sisters exactly where they are, right? And here's where the beauty of religious encounter comes in. To have an encounter with the other, we need to see them where they're at, get close to them, listen to their stories, and allow those stories to imprint on us, right? I think, you know, that's really important that encounter could not lead to solidarity, right? I can encounter you and just walk away. Yeah.
Right.
But if I allow your story to imprint on my heart, that's going to lead to this point of solidarity where I'm willing to take the other as an authentic human being that has a claim on me and that I want to be in solidarity with them. And that solidarity leads to advocacy. Advocacy leads to empowerment. And to me, that's kind of the potential, right? That's sort of the, put it this way, the impossible possibility hovering over our religions that we're all called to do, that we all fail miserably at. But there's beauty there, right? And kind of going back to your quote that you started this with, that's going to be the true judge of whether or not our religion is sincere.
Right.
Did it lead us to a humanizing view of the other?
Yeah. They will know us by our fruits. From the gospel, right?
Well said.
Me and Jesus, baby. No, I think that resonates so much with me, Josh. And I think the call, especially, and it's implicit in how you speak, just because we both come from the same tradition. But the Catholic social teaching on siblinghood is really clear. It comes from Genesis. We are all made in the image and likeness of God. And that means that we are not just siblings, but we are also reflections of the divine. And when the Abrahamic faiths in particular, who all share that creation text, take that seriously, then we're on the right track. then we're doing some good. I think one thing that that Mr. Ikeda's quote points me to is the need for religion and then people exploring religions and spiritualities to do is to do a power analysis. Think really deeply about what the faith itself is asking of you and then think about the potential of how that's being used by different people, whether that's a parent or a government or God forbid, a terrorist organization, that there are people who will always manipulate the deepest truths about who we are in order to serve their own agenda.
Right.
And unfortunately, every single way of making meaning in the world is susceptible to that manipulation. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to come into what, again, the Gospels call an adult faith, if we're going to take this responsibility of encounter seriously that Josh was talking about, then it calls us to be committed and intelligent people of spiritual practice.
Mm.
It cannot be a facile faith, because if you allow the easy answer to be the only answer, then not only are you, in my opinion, cutting off the much richer gifts of practicing any faith tradition, but you're also setting yourself up to be taken advantage of. Because any sort of black and white thinking is the type of thinking where violence thrives.
Yeah.
And if we don't challenge that from within our religious structures as well as from without, we're not going to meet the moral claims that any of our faith traditions claim that they have.
Mm.
What I do think is the positive spin on that, when you are at the same time doing your Foucauldian power analysis, you can't get out with two PhDs without mentioning Michel Foucault. We just can't. Like, there's just no way. But at the same time, you're doing this really, like, historical, social critical analysis of your faith. The real emotive power of spirituality is what I often return to.
Yeah.
Because the ways in which my faith doesn't just ask me to think, but asks me to feel, is so deeply transformative. I would not, in my opinion, I would not be as hospitable. I would not be as generous. I would not be as compassionate, and definitely not as merciful if I didn't have my tradition to ground me. I also have learned those same lessons through my engagement in interreligious spaces,
right,
through learning about Buddhist meditation and then practicing it, about learning through physical and spiritual yogic practices and then doing it myself, about learning at Juma prayer from my Muslim siblings and then being able to take that meditative approach to my Friday afternoons, right?
Mm.
There's a piece of these practices that I love the word inculcate. Man, we are academics. that makes real in my heart the ways that our faith traditions talk about how we should treat each other.
Mm.
And as much as I, in my little core, am always going to be an activist and always feel dissatisfied with these hyper-personal answers, I really do believe in them.
Yeah.
Because to your point about earlier about dialogue, if we aren't entering those spaces in ways where we are as ready as we can be, as hospitable as we can be, as generous and compassionate as we can be, then we're just going to repeat harm, or we're going to recreate hierarchies that just replicate the power structures that already exist.
Mm-hmm.
Both John Paul Lederach and Adrienne Marie Brown, two people I read often, are obsessed with imagination,
mm-hmm.
that we are in a battle for imagination,
yeah.
that we're allowing our imaginations to be constrained by AI, constrained by the, you know, technocratic oligarchs, being constrained by the quote-unquote real.
Right.
And instead, these really practical and incredibly intelligent thinkers and writers and activists are pushing us back into our dreaming.
Yeah.
And to say that without dreaming of a different future, without visualizing it, talking about it, and feeling that it's there, we're not going to do the practical work, or the practical work will feel even harder if we don't have this new way of imagining. And so I'm also going to put a plug for science fiction and any type of, work and art that bends your brain and stretches your imagination, because I think without these more what are often called fluffy sides of this work, without your feelings, without your imagination, it's going to feel really hollow, and it's not going to have the staying power that we need it to have to make the change we want.
Mm. Wow. Thank you so much, Steph. And thank you, Josh. I love this idea that our religious traditions call on us to feel. And I think in this time that we live in, it's so easy to not want to feel anything.
Yeah.
And I think earlier what you said, Josh, about really allowing ourselves to allow other stories to make an imprint on our hearts. Last thing I'll share to respond or just reflect in this moment with you both is something that you had shared, Josh, during the interfaith panel that actually as staff we've mentioned multiple times, like, remember when Josh said this, but you had said in that interfaith panel that one of the problems that you feel we have now is this failure to bother to love.
Mm-hmm. Jim Keenan. Yep.
And I really feel like that's something that we continue to think about, like, how do we use our traditions, our religious traditions, to bother to really love in this world where love seems so scarce, and that nobody else is choosing love or hope or right. And so I think just reflecting on everything you both shared, it's inspiring me to recommit, you know, to that again, despite the difficulty of it in this moment. So I just, really want to just appreciate both of you again for taking so much time on a Monday for the listeners. It's Monday morning. They all showed up here looking very sharp and bright, and just having this like really wonderful dialogue. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us in the Dialogue Studio today. I hope you are feeling motivated and inspired to engage in dialogue with someone who seems maybe very different from you. I will definitely be challenging this in my life as well. If you are interested in learning more about the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue, you can visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Stay tuned for our next episode, where I'll be speaking with two inspiring educators and nuclear disarmament activists, Masako Toki and Brennan Tierney. Thank you again, and until next time, happy dialoguing.